Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, the first year of life, a baby's brain needs love to develop. What happens in the first year is profound. It's a very, very interesting article that's in the current issue of National Geographic magazine, and the author of the piece is joining us this hour of our program to talk about the first year. He also has a daughter who I think is 3 years old, so he's been able to witness firsthand what it's like for her to be born to the point where she needs to put on sunglasses before she'll walk outside of the house. I wonder what that is. He has traveled all over the world talking to scientists about what happens in the brain. He's looked at studies that have looked at children who have received lots of attention in terms of talking to and singing to, and children who unfortunately have not received such attention, to find out what happens with IQs as a result of nurturing or lack of nurturing. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Let me first tell you a little bit about our guest. He is Udijit Bhattachary. He's formerly a staff writer at Science Magazine. He contributes to The New Yorker, National Geographic, New York Times. He's a public policy scholar at the Wilson Center and has written about all kinds of topics relating to scientific research and policy, like brain trauma caused by explosions, rivalry between two teams that shared the Nobel Prize for their discovery of the accelerating universe. He's written long-form magazine narratives about espionage, organ trafficking, cybercrime, and a story he wrote about an organ dealer in India has been anthologized in the 2011 Best American Science and Nature Writing. Udijit Bhattachary, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Is that better?
I'm sorry? Can you hear me now?
Okay, yeah, I just want you to be comfortable, though, so.
Okay, she's back on. Yeah, I'm back on. Udijit, can you hear me?
Yes, and it's Udijit Bhattachary.
Bhattachary. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us, Udijit. What a fascinating article, and it's wonderful that you've been able to couple this with the experience of having a very young child, right?
That's right. I have two of them, in fact. My older son is 9, and my daughter recently turned 4.
And it's amazing to see all that happens. I was thinking about her when you were writing about her birth and then to the point where she's putting on sunglasses. You can't leave the house unless your sunglasses are on, and she's 3 years old.
That's exactly right. She's quite a handful by now, and I'm just blown away by sort of the leaps that she has made in these first 4 years. You know, it's simply amazing, and I'm sure that I'm not alone in feeling this way. I'm sure millions of parents have experienced this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about what the brain looks like when we're first born. You write about this and the number of neurons that we have and how many we have, how they grow exponentially by the age of 3.
Right. So a baby is born with 100 billion neurons, and that's roughly the number of neurons that we have as adults. What happens by the age of 3 is, or rather 5, I should say, is that billions of connections are made between various neurons, and these neural networks sort of come into existence. And by the age of 3, there's something like a trillion neural connections that have been made in the brain. That's just remarkable.
And what do those networks do for us?
So it depends. Everything that you can imagine is controlled by these various networks: speaking, thinking, planning, locomotion, running, singing. I mean, there's various kinds of neural networks that are coming into play, some of them working together. Sometimes, A works with B, sometimes A works with C. This is, of course, a simplistic picture that I'm painting, but the idea is that these neural connections, once they're formed, are the ones that are responsible for guiding us through life.
And I have heard that they are formed, for the most part, when we're very, very young, 0 to 3. And there's also another time, maybe in adolescence, when we're also seeing an increase in the number of these connections. Is that right?
You're right. At the age of 8 or 9, there's another sort of big burst of activity, of developmental activity in the brain, where new connections are formed. And I suppose that that same process perhaps repeats once again later in life, you know, closer to adolescence. But there's definitely a lot happening, a huge amount happening between the age of, you know, a day old to 3 years old.
And what is it we need in terms of singing, conversation being spoken, for those networks to be formed the way they should be? What nurtures them? What keeps them from growing?
Well, when the baby's born with just this remarkable potential for learning, a lot of the faculties for discerning patterns of speech, for discriminating between sounds, for timing, these faculties are already sort of hardwired in the brain. But the brain needs a lot of input to then start to exercise these networks, to first of all to form them, and then to strengthen the ones that are serving a purpose, you know, such as understanding language or speaking or writing or playing. And it's only because of input that these networks get strengthened and then ultimately become capable of performing the tasks that we've been describing.
And you mentioned in the article, children in well-off families, the number of words an hour that's spoken to them compared with families who are not as well-off. The difference is really substantial. By 4, you say it's a cumulative gap of 30 million words.
It's astounding, isn't it?
Yes.
What these researchers, Risley and Hart, they were both at the University of Kansas, what they found was that well-off families, on average, were speaking about 2,200 words a day to their kids, whereas kids in the less privileged homes were being fed on a diet of 650 words a day. So these kids on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum were definitely being malnourished in a sense.
And what about if they were sitting in front of a TV, or you mentioned an audiobook or the internet or a smartphone? Does that do the same thing?
No. Surprisingly, it doesn't, and that's terribly inconvenient to some of us parents, unfortunately. What researchers at the University of Washington have found, as I've reported in the National Geographic piece, is that social interaction is really the gateway to some of this learning that we're describing, that when kids were shown audiovisual materials, in the particular experiment I describe, the kids were divided into two groups. One of them received instruction in Mandarin, shown through audiovisual materials, through tapes, you know, beautifully done audio tapes and videotapes. And the other group received instruction through interactions with a tutor who spoke to the kids in Mandarin, who played with them. And the kids who received the human interaction were able to discern pattern differences in Mandarin, were able to pick up the language much better than the other group. The other group was basically equivalent to a group that hadn't been exposed to Mandarin at all. That just goes to show the value of social interaction and how learning actually comes in through what this particular researcher at the University of Washington, Patricia Kuhl, describes as a social gate. She calls it the social gating hypothesis.
This has always been fascinating to me, and you write a little bit about how good newborns are at discriminating between different sound patterns. Are we able to continue with that discrimination as we get older, or do our brains get wired by the age of three or at some other time to a certain kind of sound pattern, which makes it more difficult for us to, say, speak another language because the sound is different?
Indeed. As I write in the piece, by the age of three, in fact, by the end of, I think, the first year of life, kids are already gravitating toward their native language, and they tend to lose. Let me back up a little bit first. When kids are born, they're able to discern differences between sounds in various languages, and that discrimination ability goes down for languages other than the native language by the age of one or two.
Ooh.
It's pretty counterintuitive. What the child gains is an ability to better discriminate between sounds in the child's native language.
I'm wondering if you had absolutely wonderful love and attention and singing to and speaking to all day long from four different people who spoke different languages and loved you very much, what the result would be.
I think it would be a marvelous result. I believe that, you know, we do have some photographs in the, you know, beautiful photographs taken that were published along with the piece in the National Geographic issue of this month, where the photographer went out and spoke to exactly those kinds of families as well, where there's four different languages being spoken at the child through the day, and the child is just growing up in this very rich, diverse linguistic environment.
Mm-hmm. You start the article by looking at a neonatologist in Philadelphia who was worried about the damage being done to crack cocaine addicted mothers, and there was a comparison of four-year-olds. It was interesting, the findings of this, that you would think that those children would have a very, very hard time with learning. But it turns out that being raised in poverty was just as much as of a deterrent to making the brain vital.
Exactly. Back in the 1980s and even the early 90s, there was a huge concern in several of the U.S.'s large cities that were being ravaged by a crack cocaine epidemic, that the kids who were being born to mothers who were on crack cocaine, would turn out to be either disabled or mentally challenged because of the exposure to crack cocaine in the womb. And when this researcher and her colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania, Hallam Hurt is the lead researcher, when she was looking at these kids, she thought she was going to find a correlation between exposure to crack cocaine and IQ. And instead, what she found was that across two groups, one of them, a group of kids who had been born to mothers who were addicted to crack cocaine, the other, a similar socioeconomic group where the mothers were not addicted to crack cocaine. And when she compared the kids in these two groups, she found that the actual correlation that made sense was between the poverty that these families were facing and the absolutely grinding poverty and terrible day-to-day circumstances. There was a greater correlation between that circumstance and the IQ. In other words, poverty was having a much more effect on the IQ of these children than crack cocaine exposure.
It's not fair, is it?
It isn't. It isn't. Because what it does is it turns poverty into sort of a gene that can be passed on from generation to generation. I spoke to some of the subjects from this Philadelphia study, I spoke to a kid who's now in his, you know, he's 19 or 21. His mother, when she had him, she had to resort to prostitution to take care of him. She used to leave him at the crack house and, you know, come back after hours and try to feed him and raise him. And so he got very little attention. By the age of 8, he was already very behind in school. As he got older, he started to steal and rob from stores. By the age of 15, he was a school dropout. By the age of 18, he himself had his own kid, and he was unable to find a job that would even pay minimum wage, and so he's now struggling to raise his own kid. He's trying to do better than his mother did, but as you can tell from this long long anecdote, there's a way in which you know, you might be stuck in your circumstance generation right. after generation.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest is the author of a piece in the current National Geographic. It's titled, The First Year, A Baby's Brain Needs Love to Develop. What happens in the first year is profound. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Yudhijit Bhattacharjee is our guest, and he is a contributor to the New Yorker, National Geographic, New York Times, currently a public policy scholar at the Wilson Center. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is Yudhijit Bhattacharjee, and we're talking about the first year of life. Daryl in La Coterie is our first caller. Hi, Daryl.
Hello. How are you today?
Okay. How are you?
I was very well, thank
Good.
You. I was calling to say that I was separated from my mother at 1 month old, and I was not reunited with her for 7 months. Although I was in a good environment, I did not receive the attunement, I believe is the word. And I get that from the book Scattered by Dr. Gabor Mate, who discusses his own experiences and his son's with ADD and ADHD. And yet, I've completed 7 years at university, 2 degrees, but mostly because of desire. But what I wanted to point out was that I understand from reading the book Scattered by Dr. Gabor Mate that the first 9 months is as critical as the first inside your mother is as critical as the second 9 months. And those are the most important year and a half of our life.
You did it.
I agree with the caller. First of all, congratulations on the way that your education has turned out. I'm really glad that things are working out for you. I didn't mean to imply at all in the story that it was okay for pregnant mothers to expose their babies in the womb to crack cocaine. Of course, it's very important to provide a good environment inside the womb to the baby, but it's equally important to provide a very good environment once the baby is born. So that's really what this story deals with.
And what about making up for lost time? If you're separated for whatever reason from your mother or father for the first year of life, can you make that time up?
I'm sure that you can. I'm sure that, you know, there's interventions, there's ways in which you can make up for the lack of nurturing and stimulation in the first few years. In fact, there's in the story, I write about a study that was done in Romania, where researchers looked at these kids who had been left in orphanages in Romania in starting sometime in the 1980s, who were being raised with almost zero attention. They'd be left in their cribs for hours. They had no physical touch, no affection, and when they were you know, 3 years, 4 years old, they were really not like average, normal, healthy kids. They had no way of expressing their emotions, and they showed almost these feral behaviors. But in the study that I report on, some of these kids were placed in foster homes, and by the age of 8 or 9, many of these kids were doing quite well. As compared to the kids that were left in the orphanages. That tells you that there's a way to remedy the lack of attention in the first few years.
And what is that?
I guess lots of love and attention and care and stimulation in the foster homes was responsible for sort of reversing the effects of the early deprivation. And I think that's key if we're going to make a difference to the lives of children who've had a very rough early childhood. I guess those are some of the commonsensical things to do so as to make a difference to their lives, to make sure that by the time they're adolescents, they're on track to have a much calmer and a much more... a life that they deserve.
Thanks, Daryl, very much for your call. John in Grand Rapids. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I was, funny you should mention Romania. I'm a social worker, and I worked with a client who was adopted from Romania, and it was not a happy, pleasant story, as you just described. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about neglect, not necessarily in utero drug use, but that too. But when what happens when a child's never picked up, diapers not changed, not fed, quit crying and quit responding to the environment around them, and are those synapses able to be reconnected in the brain that don't get developed like they should? Because my experience is those kids have lifetime issues that are very significant.
I don't disagree with that. I do believe that some of the damage, especially if it's extensive, may be irreversible. I haven't done much research on sort of the negative side on how bad things could get, but I do know, as I'm sure our caller knows from his experience, in Romania, that many of the kids in these Romanian orphanages have grown up to be very, very troubled. Many of them are homeless. They are suffering, and it's a tragic story. I don't know how one could possibly change the outcome for them, since the effects have become so deep rooted.
And if you would, tell us a little more. You mentioned this study that was done, U.S. researchers studying 136 children from Romania, from 6 institutions, to look at the impact of neglect. Tell us in more detail what the impact was.
So First of all, what the researchers saw was just these behaviors that I described earlier, where the children were not attached to any single caregiver in the orphanages. When they had an emotional reaction to something, they didn't really know how to express it. That was sort of the baseline for these kids, and I'm sure that there were lots of other problems, which I'm not touching on here. But what the researchers did was they also measured the brain activity, the electrical activity in the brains of these kids using non-invasive equipment. And they found that the electrical signals were a lot weaker than the average population of healthy children out there. Now, after the foster care of a few years where some of the kids went into foster homes where they were provided with toys, the parents were given training on how to nurture and stimulate these kids. After a few years, when their brain activity was measured again, the kids who had been left in the foster homes still showed the same weak patterns of brain activity, whereas the foster kids showed healthier patterns. So that was sort of a specific, concrete measurement of the difference that this treatment made.
Here's an interesting email from Winona. Why don't we offer subsidized daycare for small babies at nursing homes? When my grandchildren were babies, I took them along to a nursing home to visit my mother-in-law. As soon as the residents heard a baby was there, the halls filled up with people in wheelchairs wishing for a chance to even touch the baby. Many of those people would have been delighted to hold and snuggle a baby for an hour or so. And I have to think that sort of loving human interaction would make a world of difference to a young baby whose mother simply did not have time. It would also improve the lives of the residents.
I love that idea. That's
me too.
Like killing it's like killing two birds with one stone. Certainly the human interaction between these elderly people and the kids would be rewarding for both sides. And I'm sure it would do both of them a world of good.
Thanks very much, John, for your call. Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Excuse me. We have an unusual situation in our family. I had a sister who was not wanted. She was very, very severely abused by her mother. During her young years, she was separated from her mother because of her mother's illness for the first year, and she wasn't wanted. It turned out that she was extremely brilliant, very, very brilliant. She had behavior problems. She was into IV drugs by the age of 13. So I've always wondered how in the world she grew to be the brilliant person she was with those kinds of conditions.
That is that's a very good question. The story, you know, describes the whole phenomena of nurturing and what it does in general. It doesn't imply that without nurturing there couldn't be instances where a kid turned out to be brilliant. Just by sheer genetics or by other factors, including drive and motivation, education, certainly it is possible that the person that you are referring to is an exception rather than the norm.
And you said she was into drug use at the age of 13. Did that stop and she became a brilliant contributing adult, Ellen?
Yes, she did. She got herself off of drugs. She was definitely a person who gave to society. She had an unbelievable work, ethic. Mm-hmm. She never, as far as we, her sisters and brothers, feel, she was never developed enough personally or emotionally to get out and be as successful as she really should have been.
Thank you very much for your call. We go to Jeff in Waupaca. Hi.
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 Just wanted to call. My wife and I have been doing foster care for like 16 years, and we've had like 36 or 37. We get little older teens, but we've had some younger ones, and we have had the RAD children, the attention deficit disorder, and it's making friends. It's communicating. Like I said, knowing what to do, how to handle any emotion is such a major task that it's hard, and they don't know how to communicate to people. how to just deal with everyday situations and emotions.
So how do you deal with that? How do you nurture them?
Well, you do as best you can. And there's times they're in and out. They have the police involved, and they're a lot of anger issues is what ends up being. Just blow up, just almost to the point of blacking out with anger because they don't even realize what's going on. They're just breaking things, destroying, you know, smashing things. They get to that point where they don't know how to handle it. So the last two that I know of that I knew really had it bad, it was just anger. It was just so much anger built up inside them, and you just try to – we've learned how to handle it, to kind of back away. Don't push the situation until after they've had that time to breathe and calm down, and they walk away, and a half hour or so later, then you can finally start communicating with them. But if you try to approach that situation at that time, you it's just going to escalate into the police being involved and everything on top of that.
You did it. What do you say?
Well, hats off to the caller and his wife. Hats off to you for taking on this challenge. I can't imagine how much sacrifice and restraint and dedication it must take to be not only fostering kids, but also to foster some kids who have these challenges. In the story, I cover an intervention program that's been developed at the University of Oregon, where researchers have come up with ways in which parents can become better parents. And, of course, this applies not just to parents like the person who's called in, who are fostering kids, but also parents, you know, who are just parenting their own children. And I think a part of the training does have to do with how to regulate the parents' own emotions, as well as help the children to regulate theirs. It seems to be that many of the behavioral challenges that parents face from their kids comes precisely from what the caller has identified, the inability to regulate emotions, to express them in an appropriate manner, and then get over them. So that's part of the training, and I think that that's essentially what the caller is trying to tell us when he says, you know, that it's, you know, if it's an explosive situation, he and his wife kind of tend to leave the kid alone and then come back after half an hour or so to start communicating. I think that's a very smart thing to do.
There ought to be a way, I don't know if you have a suggestion of how to do this, for all of us to learn about parenting, because it's such an enormous thing to do in your life, isn't it? You have two children, you know this. To bring this being into the world who's helpless, and you're so responsible, and there's just so much to know. And a lot of it we just learn. I don't even know how we learn it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. It's such a huge challenge. It's such a huge responsibility. And most parents are completely unprepared, especially when their first child arrives. You know, no matter how much planning they've done, they just don't know how to handle the challenges that come in the first year of parenting a child. My wife and I struggle with it every day. I mean, we're sort of out of the woods somewhat because our kids are now a little bit older, but there are still times when we just don't know exactly, you know, whether a stern reprimand is the right way to go, or whether reading a book, ad nauseum is the right way to go, or because we just don't have enough patience, enough bandwidth to use a contemporary term to deal with the challenges of parenting. And I think that I'm not alone in saying this. I think millions of parents struggle with it. They've struggled with it for generations. Some of them tend to get better quickly. others not so much. I don't have a good answer as to how we can all become better parents, but I do think researchers, the ones at the University of Oregon, and I think there are other programs like it, have come up with ways in which parents can become better parents to their own kids.
Thanks, Jeff, very much for your call. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, we would love to hear from you, is 800-486-8655. Our guest has written a piece that appears in the current issue of National Geographic. It's The First Year a Baby's Brain Needs Love to Develop. What happens in the first year is profound. Yudhijit Bhattacharjee is our guest, and our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. It's an interesting question. Maybe you can provide the answer. Where should we be learning how to become parents? It is such a big thing to do in life. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Chris in Grafton is next. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Marlene. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking earlier about how important it was to communicate with infants and small children. My wife has got her master's in reading. She's done a few papers on that specific subject. And the single best thing that I know you can do is sit down literally from day one and spend 30 to 45 minutes to your child reading, because it not only gives them language and all the other things that come with that, but I personally feel if you'll read to your child from day one and the child gets used to laying in your lap and listening, they learn how to relax within themselves because they love to learn or hear being read to. So much that they will sit there and they learn how to relax and say within themselves.
What a wonderful point. That's absolutely right. I think every one of these programs that I've been talking about, including the one at the University of Oregon, I think focuses on how to get parents to read more to their children. And I think that's been known for generations. What researchers have found out is that it's not just how much you read, but also how you read. And so in the program that I've been mentioning, parents are taught to read in more creative ways, where if you're reading a book where it says, you know, Jack ran up the hill, you can then take a break from the book and talk about, I don't know, you can talk about how it's harder to walk up a hill rather than run down the hill, and then introduce the concept of gravity or something. It's just remarkable the extent of learning capacity that children have from a very early age. And as parents, we sometimes tend to think that, oh, you know, what's a baby going to understand of this or that? But books and reading, it's not just linguistic input, but it's actually input about the world. It's about characters. It's about values. It's about the environment. It's about laws of physics. And as you're reading to your child is getting not just language, but emotional regulation from the inflection and tone of your voice, as getting to, you know, discriminate between various sounds. I mean, it's the list is endless of the amount of the various categories of things that the child is getting through that reading experience.
And singing, I would imagine, as well, right?
Absolutely. Singing, when I was talking to Patricia Kuhl at the University of Washington, she's the researcher who did the study involving Mandarin instruction. She was explaining how we're drawn to kind of coo at babies, to say things like, hello, how are you doing today? And speak to babies in this sing-song voice, because somehow that communicates a lot more information. It allows kids to sort of learn social cognition, to learn to read the emotions of others, and probably a host of other things that I'm overlooking in this conversation.
Chris, thank you. John in Milwaukee, you're on the air.
Hi. I agree totally with the last caller, especially about the reading. My father spent a lot of time reading with me. And you're right, everything you guys were saying, it helps build cognition and things like that. But I wanted to talk about my brother, because we were both adopted, but I was too young to really know about that at the time. Our father had been killed, and maybe it's around the same time my mother was seeing somebody, and he took us in, and there was a story about when my brother found out that my father had died, and they were outside, and my brother told me that he felt like his knees collapsed, or, you know, he went numb, and my father now was like on the porch, and he ran up behind him and, you know, grabbed him. And he said he never felt anything like that before. Hmm. So what I think learning from my father is that it takes a willpower, a really strong willpower, to just look past any problems that the kid might have, or, you know, insecurities and anxieties and things like that. And, he never gave up on us, not once. And I think that I wouldn't be where I am today without him, you know, seeing especially how he was there for my brother. And, you know, my brother was older, so he had a lot more knowledge of what was going on. I didn't understand or even learn about it till I was a little older. So I'm just thankful for that. And I think that's a huge part of it, too, is just the willpower and understanding for the children.
What a nice tribute to him.
That I found that to be a very touching story, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that a lot of the listeners feel the same way. It is absolutely true that to have a father figure, especially if you don't have a father, who is totally devoted to you and is standing behind you through life, can make all the difference between being centered and stable and successful and unraveling. I think enough can't be said about the power of good parenting. And I think there really ought to be a national, international conversation about how we can all be better parents, how, you know, no matter how old our children, or whether our children are our biological children or their adopted children or stepchildren, what we can do to give them more nurturing, more stimulation, better input early in life. I think it could change the world.
Mm, I do, too. Thanks, John. And we go to Joan in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Oh, hi. Good morning, or good afternoon. Well, I'm excited about your program, and it's so wonderful to hear a conversation being opened about parenting. And actually, I didn't hear anything about what a good parent is, except I've heard attributes. But, you know, my feeling is that the parent is like a cheerleader rather than a dictatorial, I know the way and I'm showing you this and this is the way. But a cheerleader saying, yeah, you're doing good, you know. And I don't believe that there is any time in life that is too old to be reparented. And I know a therapist that does a lot of reparenting with very good results. In fact, I had a little bit of it, and it changed my life even at the age of 40. and turned me around to being a very happy person. And I unfortunately didn't have that experience before I raised my own children, so I was raising them according to how I was raised, you know, like, you know, doing the right thing and discipline and all that. So this validation of the new life as being a person in their own right comes from parents as a primary source, or a good therapist or a good friend or a good mentor, you know, being the cheerleader for them. That I think that spurs them on more than anything.
What do you think, you digit?
I love that point that the caller has just made. I think all kids require that sort of validation, and I think validation is sort of a good summary of everything that we've been talking about. I do believe, for example, I struggle with this with my own son. You know, he's in fourth grade, and when he comes home from school and I ask him what happened in school, what homework he's got, etc., often I'm driven to ask him why he didn't do well at something, why he, you know, why his handwriting isn't better, why he didn't write more perfect sentences, if even that's possible. But sometimes my wife will take me aside and say, "What are you doing? Why are you being, you know, so demanding? Why don't you just encourage him?" And then I try that, and sometimes I'm amazed at the results of simply cheerleading, as the caller described it, instead of being demanding. At the same time, as a parent, I know that it's also my role to explain what I expect, to have high expectations of my kids. So it just goes back to what you were saying earlier, Kathleen, about parenting being such a huge challenge, because all of these things have to be there in appropriate measure for a parent to be a really good parent.
I hadn't heard this before. When Joan was talking about being reparented at the age of 40, I guess through therapy, I guess that's what therapy does, right? That because a lot of people have parents who aren't terrific, and it could be a challenge for their whole lives. They need to be reparented.
I suppose so. I'd never heard that term before. I'd always heard of therapy as being therapy, but I guess it makes sense to think of certain types of therapy as reparenting, where the therapist essentially provides the same kind of nurturing, care, attention, listening, which sometimes, you know, even a spouse or a best friend can provide. And I think the caller did mention friends as serving that role as
yes.
well. But it makes me think about parenting in a larger, broader sense as being more caring and paying attention to the needs of other people. And I guess parents are sort of the parenting is the epitome of that kind of caring thinking towards another individual.
Thanks, Joan. Elizabeth in Fish Creek. Hi.
Hi there. It sounds like you are researching or exploring the scientific underpinnings of attachment theory, which I understand to be not only an exploration of the, it doesn't just recognize the importance of the interaction between the caregiver and the child, but also the nature of the relationship between the caregiver and the child, meaning that I know there's a strong attachment parenting movement which believes that it's really important for kids to be spending most of their time with a primary caregiver or with someone within that trusted kind of extended clan. And I'm also going to say that, you know, it wasn't that long ago that John Bowlby was derided for saying that attachment was the reason that these children in hospitals and orphanages had a failure to thrive. People thought that they were suffering from a germ called hospitalism. So this is really remarkably new that we're identifying that children need all of this. But my real question is, are you seeing that there is a significance in valuing the actual relationship that the child has with the caregiver as one being built on trust?
We have about 30 seconds, you did it.
I suppose that those are all very good points, and I hadn't heard of some of the literature that that the caller is referring to. But of course, I think trust is sort of at the heart of the relationship between the child and the caregiver, and I don't think that you can expect any kind of nurturing or stimulation or other things from a caregiver that the child doesn't trust. That's the whole reason why in those Romanian orphanages, the kids were not getting anything at all. They were not getting any input because there was no caregiver that they had formed an attachment to. And they showed a complete inability to form that attachment later in life mm-hmm. with anybody. They just couldn't trust anyone. They were just out there on their own in the big bad world.
Yudhijit, thank you so much for being with us. His whole article is in the current issue of National Geographic, titled The First Year. Yudhijit Bhattacharjee, our guest. He is a contributor to National Geographic and currently a public policy scholar at the Wilson Center. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this program and for doing on-air production as well. Great conversations ahead.